I'm a risk communication consultant based in New York.
I take it that's not a really enormous specialty, is it?
Well, I'm one of the people that started it. So, when I started out, it wasn't a specialty at all. But now, once in a while, I'll meet somebody on an airplane and, I'll ask them what they do and they'll say, oh, I'm in risk communication. So it has turned into a field in the last 25, 30 years.
Now, the reason why PJ found you is because it seemed to infuriate him, especially during this examination that the nation appears to be going through about NSA surveillance, that often he hears the construction, well, X kills as many people as, 30,000 more people die from X than from terrorism. Now, you don't have to be a risk analyst to get a sense that sort of X kills more than Y construction is a little bit bogus. But why do we feel that way?
Well, it's a very complicated question. I mean, there are so many things wrong with that comparison, that more people die, whatever, tripping on, over their feet on the stairs than from terrorism. So many things wrong with that comparison. But let me tell you some of the specific things that are wrong, and then get to the big thing that's wrong that mm-hmm. I think is where we really ought to focus our time. And then if you want to edit out the specific things, you can do that. One obvious thing that's wrong with that particular comparison is, when you say, terrorism hasn't killed very many people, therefore we shouldn't do surveillance, the proponents of surveillance will say, well, the reason terrorism hasn't killed very many people is precisely that we're doing good surveillance. So it's always hard to know the difference between a precaution that's unnecessary and a precaution that's working. But you certainly don't want to say just because the bad thing hasn't happened, the precaution is unnecessary, or you wouldn't take any effective precautions. So it's nonsense on that grounds alone. Beyond that, terrorism, particularly if you think about terrorism in the context of a dirty bomb or a nuclear weapon or a biological weapon, is a low probability, high magnitude event. It's catastrophic when it happens, but it doesn't happen very often. And that's exactly the kind of event where it's most misleading to say it hasn't happened yet, therefore we shouldn't worry about it. I mean, we could say that about global warming. BP could have said that about Deepwater Horizon before that happened. It had never happened before. So when you're looking at a potentially horrific but not very likely event, it's particularly irrelevant to look at, the fact that it hasn't happened very often in the past as a reason for not taking precautions. That's number two.
There
are more. And then I'm going to get to the one I think is the big one. It's also worth noticing that the main public concern about terrorism isn't fear anyway. If you ask people, even people in Manhattan, are you upset about terrorism? A lot of people will say yes. And if you ask them, do you think you or anyone you love is likely to die in a terrorist attack? Most of them will say no. And then if you say, well, if you don't think it's likely to get you, why are you worried about it? People say, well, I'm not worried about it getting me. I'm thinking it's probably going to happen. When it happens, it's going to be depressing. It's going to make me miserable. I'm going to have to talk to my kids about it. I'm going to go through another month like the month after 9/11 of thinking about nothing else. It's an awful thing to contemplate. So misery captures how people feel about terrorism, I think, better than fear does.
I wonder whether you're maybe centering that third argument on living here in New York City, because New Yorkers, I think, my sense is that they are less worried about this issue, even though it was the epicenter of 9/11, than much of the rest of the country, because they don't watch as much Fox News. I mean, that this is partly a politically generated hysteria?
Well, I mean, certainly, the concern about if you look at two risks, if you look at the terrorism risk versus the surveillance risk, that's going to be ideological. That's going to be very political. If you're on the right, you're likely to be more worried about terrorism than about surveillance. Privacy strikes you as, maybe less important than getting attacked. If you're on the left, it's likely to be in the other direction. But when you look at surveys, you know, across the country, not just in New York, and you ask people, you know, what's your main, when you think about terrorism, is your main response that a terrorist attack is likely to kill you, or that it's likely to kill somebody and that would make you very angry and very miserable? They say the latter. So people get it that the odds of any particular individual getting killed in a terrorist attack are low.
In anything. Aren't we all immortal?
Well.
let's get to that last point, the most important one.
No, I'm going to get to that last point. But, you know, I mean, I think it's very important when talking about terrorism to realize that it's not mostly about fear. But let me get to the biggie. Okay. The biggie is that generically, put terrorism aside, people's main response to risk isn't quantitative. It's not statistical. If you distinguish two characteristics of a risk, how dangerous is it, which really is quantitative, versus how scary is it, how upsetting is it? And, you know, let's give them labels. Let's call how dangerous it is hazard. Let's call how upsetting it is outrage. Okay, then the correlation between hazard and outrage is extremely low. People who are interested in the number, it's about 0.2, accounting for a glorious 4% of the variance, which is essentially no variance at all. So, what this means is if you know a risk is dangerous, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's dangerous.
But why doesn't it? What are the elements that make something terrifying or outrageous even when it isn't so dangerous?
Well, I mean, there are maybe 25 or 30 sources of outrage in the literature, but let me just run through some of them. Trust is a biggie. If I trust you, I'm going to find the risk that you are exposing me to much more acceptable than if I don't trust you.
So if you're father's driving a car, you're not as scared as you are of the unknown pilot piloting your plane?
Well, it depends who you are. You may think the unknown pilot is a lot more trustworthy than your father. But certainly, you know, I mean, if you trust the government to tell you that surveillance is no big deal and they're going to do it responsibly, you're going to have a different response than if you think that the government is not to be trusted. If you trust a company which says, don't worry about our emissions, you know, we've got them under good control, then maybe you'll shrug it off. If you don't trust the company, then the emissions are going to be more upsetting. So trust is one. Control is one. If it's under my control, I'm going to be more upset than if it's under your control. Familiarity.
I'm confused there. If it's under your control, you're going to be more upset?
Sorry, I said it backwards. Control is one. If it's under my control, I'm going to be less upset than if it's under your control. That's why people would rather drive than ride shotgun. If I'm in control, I feel safer. If you're in control, I get scared.
Rightly so.
Familiarity is one. Familiar risks generate a lot less outrage than unfamiliar risks. Memorability goes in the other direction. Memorable risks generate more outrage than unmemorable risks. If you can remember awful things happening, or you can even visualize, you can picture, you can imagine awful things happening, that makes the risk more memorable. That makes it more a source of outrage. And there are lots of other factors. But what's key here is that outrage has a much higher correlation with perceived hazard than hazard has with perceived hazard. Now that's kind of like a tongue twister, but let's take it apart. What I'm saying is the main control over whether you think something is dangerous isn't whether it's actually dangerous, it's whether it's actually upsetting.
But you don't endorse this, do you? I mean, isn't it helpful to set our priorities to know that household accidents, which are preventable, cause more deaths than terrorism?
Yes. It's not like I go around urging people to ignore hazard and focus on outrage. On the other hand, it's very pointless to go around urging people to ignore outrage and focus on hazard, because they won't do it. You look at a my typical client, okay, and let's say a company is you know, manufacturing company has neighbors, and the neighbors are worried that the emissions of this company are going to give their children cancer. And the main determinant of how worried the neighbors are going to be is outrage. So it's, you know, is it familiar? Is the risk familiar? Is the company trustworthy? All right, and let's assume a company that is mishandling the outrage badly. Mm-hmm. You know, so that they're being contemptuous of people.
Can you hold just a moment? I have a horrible, and I don't like the fact that. All right, well, it's starting again, but it's the exact same picture as the other picture, which means that I'm definitely, I got the rest of it.
You're
just
getting it.
Absolutely getting it. So, cancer, child. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I didn't want to miss anything. Go ahead.
Okay. Let's look at a company, and let's assume the neighbors of that company are worried that the emissions coming out of the factory are going to give your children cancer. And let's assume that the company is mishandling the outrage. So when people express concern, the company management is contemptuous. And when people say, tell us about your emissions, tell us what's going out the stack, the company says, oh, don't worry your pretty little head about it, sweetheart. You wouldn't understand it anyway. And then when they finally give the numbers, they give dishonest numbers. They give the wrong numbers. They lie. Okay, so you have lots of reasons to mistrust this company, lots of reasons to dislike this company. Okay, the outrage is legitimately high. Now, that doesn't tell you anything about the hazard. So what the company says is people just need to learn that because we're acting like a jerk, that doesn't mean we're killing them. Okay, it would be useful for people to learn that, but what would be more useful is for the company to learn that if it wants people to think it's not killing them, it needs to stop acting like a jerk.
And that's where you come in?
That's where I come in. I come into the company, and the company says, look, we're not killing people, but they think we are. And I say, well, they don't think you are because they're stupid. They think you're killing them because you're acting like a jerk. You're doing this wrong and this wrong and this wrong and this wrong. And if you stop doing those things, if you stop doing things that arouse a lot of outrage, you'll earn the right for people to reconsider the hazard. I mean, if the outrage is low, then people's response to the risk is going to be much more a function of how much how serious the hazard really is.
Okay, so reputation management is about a third of what you do, or at least one of the three principal things that you do. The other is to advise people on how to increase alertness or perhaps outrage when it comes to the presence of a hazard. And yet another thing you do is to show people or companies or groups how to diminish outrage over a potential hazard, I hope in proportion to the danger that hazard presents, but I know that when people work in reputation management, you sometimes get pushed hither and yon. But tell me how you can increase the public sense of outrage and then how you are able to diminish it.
Okay, I mean, let's get clear on the structure of this first. You did a pretty good job with it, but let me take a crack at the structure
Sure.
of this. I mean, if you look at hazard and outrage, and you construct a 2x2 table, high hazard or low hazard, high outrage or low outrage. Let's do that, and people can do that in their heads. If hazard is low and outrage is high, that is, you've got a risk that's not very dangerous but is very upsetting, then the job is outrage management. Then you're trying to calm people down, and that's what you called reputation management. And it is largely reputation management. It's trying to get people not to overreact to a small risk. Okay. And by the way, the way you calm people down is not by saying calm down. It's certainly not by saying calm down, you hysterical fool. Mm-hmm. So calming people down is the goal. It's the paradigm, but it's not the message.
So you've partially answered that question already by saying give them information.
Oh, you want to give them information, but you also want to be responsive. You want to listen to them. You want to let them vent and express their concerns. You want to acknowledge the ways in which you've misbehaved in the past and the ways in which the problem is real. Let's take a situation, that most of your listeners are going to think is genuinely low hazard, like vaccination. Okay, and, you know, I mean, most people, not everybody, but most people agree that most vaccines do more good than harm. That, you know, they're not harm-free, but, you know, you're better off vaccinated against the diseases for which there is a vaccine than you are unvaccinated. All right, but if you're the CDC or you're some public health department and you're dealing with a parent who's anxious about giving her child vaccine, now you're in a situation where you're trying to reduce the outrage about the vaccine in order that the parent will find it acceptable to take the vaccine. It's not mostly telling the parent that it's foolish to worry about vaccine. It's not mostly telling the parent that she should stop listening to these activists who are misleading her. It's much more listening to the parent's concerns. It's partly acknowledging that there is some truth to those concerns. The strongest argument in the toolkit of opponents of vaccination is the dishonesty of vaccination proponents about the very small risk that's real. So if you're 98% right and pretending to be 100% right, then the advocates of that 2% nail you, you know, and they say, well, what the CDC is not being honest about is, and they point to the 2%. So, you know, so there's a great deal to be done other than educating people in order to get their outrage low enough that they want to be educated. I mean, when people don't understand the data, it's not because they can't. It's because they choose not to. And that's a function of outrage. So if you can reduce the outrage, then they're more interested in the data. Then you can begin to educate them.
So how do you increase the outrage?
All right, that's the other side of the coin. If you're in a situation where people are genuinely endangered but not very upset, then your goal is to get them more upset. That's what I sometimes call precaution advocacy. If the paradigm in outrage management is calm down, the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out. This could kill you. Do something. Wear a seatbelt. Wear a hard hat. Wear a condom. Not necessarily all at the same time.
I'm sure it's happened.
You know, and there's a variety of strategies, some of them very simple and very obvious, like keep your message short. Not important in outrage management to keep your message short, but in precaution advocacy, it's essential because you're talking to apathetic people, and apathetic people have a short attention span.
This is your brain on drugs?
This is your brain on a different channel. This is your brain thinking about other things.
No, I mean, what'd you think of that campaign?
I see what you mean. I haven't seen the data about that campaign, but you know, anything that captures your interest, you know, is likelier to make some progress in converting apathy into at least attention. I mean, there are stages in moving toward taking a risk seriously.
Give me an example.
Okay. Let's suppose that I want to get people to... all right, let me think about it for a minute. Mm-hmm. A good precaution advocacy example. All right, I want to get people to wear seatbelts. Okay? And the main problem in people who don't wear seatbelts isn't that they're outraged by the seatbelt. So seatbelts are not like vaccine. People are outraged about vaccine. It's not so much apathy as outrage that gets in the way. But people who don't wear seatbelts, they may not like them, but mostly they're not worried enough about the car crashing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now you're trying to grab their attention, you're trying to increase their outrage. One of the things that demonstrably works well with seatbelts and well in generally in precaution advocacy is scaring people. So those scary driver's ed movies that, you know, they make teenagers watch actually do a lot of good.
Really? You've seen data on that?
Absolutely. I've seen data on that. I mean, the problem with scaring people is you get used to it after a while. You get desensitized. So, you know, the first scary movie in driver's ed does a lot more good than the 10th scary movie in driver's ed.
You still run into the credibility issue with some of that stuff. Like, I remember the anti-smoking film when I was a kid that showed people's fingers black and falling off because of something called Berger's syndrome. And I know that it exists, and I've seen it on subway pictures now, but, you know, so many more people smoke than have that. It's in my mind, I can't imagine that's a serious risk. And then there was the anti-marijuana movies, and they just lacked all credibility because they countered what one's experience in life was.
Absolutely. I mean, scaring people is useful, but, you know, if you try to scare people and fail, you know, and credibility is going to contribute to that failure, then it doesn't only not work, it backfires. Right, you tried to scare me, and you tried to scare me with bullshit, and I'm, you know, now I'm not only not scared and not interested, now I'm beginning to be outraged at you for trying to arouse outrage about something in an illegitimate way. So yeah, I mean, all risk communication can backfire. Outrage management can backfire. Precaution advocacy can backfire. So, you know, credibility is always going to be an issue, and you don't try to scare people in ways that they're not going to find believable.
Getting back to precaution advocacy, you said scaring people is a good way to begin. Other tips?
Sure. And some of these are too obvious to sound very interesting, but, you know, role models work. You know, if people you admire take precautions, then you're likelier to take those precautions.
Lorne Greene buying into, well, no one can even remember who he is anymore, probably, but some trusted actor buying gap insurance, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Again, you know, as you say, credibility is going to be an issue. If you think he's pretending to buy the insurance because he got paid to claim that he's buying the insurance, then you're gonna get a boomerang effect.
I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV.
Yeah, exactly. But I was actually reading a study just this morning that one of the most effective things in persuading people to get vaccinated against the swine flu pandemic a couple of years ago was when President Obama got his children vaccinated. And that, you know, that generated some trust. If Obama, you know, is not worried about the vaccine, then maybe I shouldn't worry about the vaccine either. So it did some good outrage management vis-a-vis people who were worried about the vaccine. But more than that, you know, if Obama takes time out of his busy schedule to get his children vaccinated, then maybe I ought to take time out of my busy schedule to get my children vaccinated. It addressed the apathy. So role models are useful. And then there are much more complicated, much more sophisticated strategies of doing precaution advocacy that are hard to summarize. But you know, one example of a strategy that's very powerful is if you can get people to do a behavior that doesn't necessarily make sense to them because they don't have the attitude that to support that behavior, then, you know, if you just get them to do it because they want to be nice, you know, or because you pay them to do it, once they have done the behavior, they begin to wonder why they did it. This is called cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is a very strong motivator for learning things that you wouldn't otherwise want to learn. A nice example of this is most people who have ever distributed petitions, ever try to ask people to sign petitions, notice that more people sign your petition and then read your literature than read your literature and then sign your petition. They sign the petition to be courteous, and then the act of signing the petition makes them wonder, what did I do? What did I sign? You know, I don't. This doesn't make sense to me. I just did something I haven't got any attitude support for. Then they read the literature in order to teach themselves that what they did made sense and to develop an attitude that supports the behavior. Well, this strategy is often called the foot in the door strategy. It's a very powerful precaution advocacy strategy. You get people to start a new precaution for silly reasons, for crappy reasons, and then you rely on cognitive dissonance to make them want to learn better reasons for that same precaution. And you provide that information, but the foot in the door is what made them want to learn the information in the first place.
Cognitive dissonance is taking an action that doesn't make sense to you.
That's right.
Like signing the petition. Can you give me another?
Another example of cognitive dissonance? Yeah, well, I mean, role modeling is largely grounded in cognitive dissonance. That is, you know, I mean, most people don't feel like just because a famous movie star does something, I ought to do it. That's not intellectually sound. But they want to be like the movie star. So I do it because the movie star does it. And then I say to myself, well, that was stupid. You know, I'm not the sort of person who just, you know, emulates movie stars. Then I begin to look for better reasons to do it. But even paying people money is a very interesting spur to cognitive dissonance. Let's suppose I ask you to give a speech saying things you don't believe in. I ask you to go talk to your children and try to convince them of something that you don't actually believe. Okay? Now, if I just ask you to do that with no incentive, you'll say no, you'll refuse to do it. If I say, I'll pay you $100,000 to do that, you'll do it. For $100,000, you'll say something you don't believe. But there will be no attitude change because you know why you did it. You did it for the $100,000. But suppose I say, I'll give you $20 to do it. You know, or whatever, I don't know what the number would be for you because I don't know you well enough. But there is some number that is enough of an incentive to get you to do it, but not of enough of an incentive to get you to feel that was a good enough reason to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and if I can get the incentive just right, if I can get the reward just right, you'll go do the behavior for the reward, and you'll still experience cognitive dissonance because the reward isn't a good enough reason in your own assessment of yourself. Then you'll go look for better reasons to do it. So when I pay you $100,000 to tell your children something you don't believe, you wind up still not believing it. But if I give you $20 to tell your children something you don't believe, you tell your children that thing, then you look for information to because the $20 is not a good enough motive, you look for information to prove that what you said was right, and you wind up changing your own opinion.
In your professional life, how do you apply that idea? Because obviously the groups or corporations or whoever it is you may work for is unlikely to be able to find that sweet spot for every individual to get the foot in the door with cash. So how do you apply that concept?
Well, you look for other ways of finding the sweet spot. I mean, the basic principle of finding a motive that's enough to generate an initial behavior, but not enough to justify that behavior in the minds of people, that's something you get to do. I mean, here's an example that almost everybody in the audience has experienced. You know, well, at least people who are my age and I suspect even your age, I'll go back to seatbelts. A lot of people, I mean, people now wear seatbelts because it's habit. Okay, but when seatbelts first became common, a lot of people started wearing seatbelts, and the reason they started wearing seatbelts was because they didn't want to get a ticket. Or, if they're parents, the reason they started wearing seatbelts is because their children had learned in school that seatbelts were a good thing, and their children were saying, Daddy, Mommy, put on your seatbelt, and were kind of throwing a little tantrum in the backseat because the parents were not wearing seatbelts. So you put on your seatbelt in order not to get a ticket, or you put on your seatbelt in order not to earn your children's disapproval. Well, those feel like crappy reasons. The odds of getting a ticket for not wearing a seatbelt are very, very low. And you're not supposed to be led around by the nose by your children. So those are dumb reasons. They were good enough to motivate the behavior, but not good enough to make sense out of the behavior. So huge numbers, millions and millions and millions of people started wearing seatbelts, and in the years after they started wearing seatbelts, started believing in seatbelts.
Now let's take today the argument over NSA surveillance. Where would you come down on this? Would you come down on the side of ramping up the outrage or ramping up or rather tamping it down?
Well, I guess it would depend on who you are.
I'm asking you.
Then it would depend on who my client was, I guess. Let's take the two different positions, okay? If you are the NSA or you are the government, okay? So you want people to think that surveillance is a good thing, okay? You have two possible things you can do. One is to ramp up the outrage about terrorism, to get people more worried about terrorism. And the other is to ramp down the outrage about surveillance, to persuade people because that's too cognitive, to get people less upset about surveillance. And you can see the government trying to do both. If the government is thinking hard, it's paying real attention to which of those is more important, trying to figure out is my problem that people are not worried enough about terrorism, or is my problem that people are excessively upset about invasion of privacy?
And it's your experience, isn't it, that fear and outrage is a far greater motivator?
Yeah, I would say we usually make mistakes in one direction rather than the other. We usually think we have a precaution advocacy problem when we really have an outrage management problem more than the other way around. Your face tells me that didn't make sense to you. So let me expand on it. Okay, if you're worried, are people, if you're trying to ask yourself, are people too upset about the precaution, or not upset enough about the hazard? Okay, the odds are people are too upset about the precaution. That's the more common problem. Mm-hmm. So if you've got people who aren't wearing their seatbelt, it's likelier that you're going to make more progress getting them to be less anti-seatbelt than more worried about car accidents. Mm-hmm. If they're not getting vaccinated, it's probably more because they're worried about vaccines than because they're not worried about infectious diseases.
Ah, so in that case, if one were the government or the NSA, one would spend more time calming people down about the surveillance than hyping the fear of terrorism.
Yeah, if you're right about that. I mean, you don't want to guess at that, you want to do a quick and dirty survey and find out, are people, which is your problem, or what is the relative size of those two problems? Too worried about surveillance or not worried enough about terrorism?
It does seem polls suggest that people aren't all that worried about surveillance, that a majority of them would prefer not to have it, but they're willing to trade it in for security. I was thinking that the government's best move would be to offer actual stories of plots that were foiled through this kind of surveillance.
Which, as you know, it's in the process of doing. Whether they're actual stories or fictional stories is remains to be determined, but they are telling us stories. I'm guessing here about something that they have data on, and if I were working for them, which I hasten to add I'm not, I would have data on. But for what it's worth, my guess would be that you're right about most people, but you're not right about the controversy. That is, my guess is most people are willing to accept surveillance as protection against terrorism. They're more worried about terrorism than they are about surveillance. But the people who are most worried are people who are most worried about surveillance. That is, the people for whom this issue is interesting but not gripping are on the government side. The people for whom this issue is gripping, I'm guessing, tend to be on the other side.
So now, let's say you're working for that side, privacy advocacy group, or civil libertarians who have long spoken about the lack of transparency when it comes to these kinds of surveillance techniques. How would you boost the nation's sense of hazard on their behalf?
Yeah, you'd start...
That's the wrong term, right? It would be boost the... I get hazard and... precaution. Well, the hazard arrives out of the precaution, right? Boost the scent of hazard as opposed to risk. I'm fucking this up. All right.
It's just
the terminology is not coming trippingly to my tongue yet. But let me just say, how would you get the public more concerned about what the government is doing than what the government says it's trying to prevent?
Well, you'd start with the same choice the government has, or the mirror image of the same choice. That is, you'd start by saying, which is going to do me more good, to try to get people less worried about terrorism or to try to get people more worried about surveillance? So that's the mirror image of the government's question. And there, I would guess that you're going to want to try to get the people more worried about surveillance, that which is why, to go back to the thing you started this interview with, the comparison that starts saying, terrorism isn't killing very many people, I think it's probably not a very powerful thing to say for a lot of reasons.
It doesn't work.
And this gets us, we're going around full circle here, the dominant reason it doesn't work is that, you know, when you compare two risks and you're talking about hazard and the people you're talking to are thinking in terms of outrage, okay, they're going to hear you through the lens that they're using, not the lens that you're using. So if you compare a high hazard, low outrage risk to a high outrage, low hazard risk, and you're comparing hazards and you're saying, you know, our factory emissions are less dangerous than driving your car, and they're comparing outrage and they're thinking driving my car is less upsetting than your factory, then it feels to them like you're lying. You know, you may not be lying, you're talking about hazard, but they're not hearing you about hazard, they're hearing you about outrage, and in outrage terms you're just wrong. You know, so it feels like you're lying. So that's what's wrong generically with saying, you know, X kills more people than Y, when X is something that's low outrage and Y is something that's high outrage, you know, people are going to feel like you're lying even if you're absolutely right on the data. All right, now let's apply that to terrorism, okay? If I were trying to get people to be more upset about PRISM and more upset about other kinds of NSA surveillance, I would not, you know, at least my guess would be, I'd look at data, but my guess would be I'm not going to want to focus on telling people they're fools to worry about terrorism. I would make much more progress, I think, telling people that the privacy worries that they have suppressed. I mean, it's not like people don't care about privacy. People do care about privacy, but they have suppressed those worries. And I would try to sort of reawaken those worries. So, I mean, you know, again, my first shot, if I got hired, you know, tomorrow by, you know, the defenders of Snowden. And I'm not working on for either side on this issue, so I'm talking completely theoretically. But if I were trying to do anti-NSA communication, risk communication, I would be talking about, you know, this means you. Yes, you don't say anything on the phone that you're worried about the government knowing. You know, you don't. Maybe you don't call anybody that you don't want the government to know you called. But here are the ways this might get in your way. Here are the ways that this might come back to haunt you. Here are the ways that, you know, this could get to your employer. Here are the ways that, you know, if the government is doing it now about terrorism, maybe they're going to be doing it in 10 years about tax evasion. And suddenly it occurs to you that you weren't entirely honest about your taxes. And could they find that out from an algorithm grounded in all the data about your phone calls and emails, and you begin to think, oh, shit. You know, and I would be trying to make real, emotionally real, real in outrage terms for people that invasion of privacy, you know, invading the privacy of terrorists isn't something they shouldn't care about.
Awesome. One more question for you. Fracking. There seems to be a dearth of hard information about fracking. Congressional hearings can point to the lack of proof that specific chemicals involved in fracking have been found in people's drinking water, though other bad things have been found after the fracking. The companies that do the fracking seem to have a monopoly on the hard information. People who want to blow the whistle, you know, there are films and movie stars and so on, are finding it a harder sell perhaps than they might expect because it's cheap and it's domestic energy. And it also brings money to communities, at least initially. So what would you do if you were on... Right now, I may be about to speak to an activist, depending on how I lay out the show. Either I've already spoken to, I'm going to put it both ways. I've spoken to an activist who says that the industry seems to be winning this issue, or I'm about to speak to an activist who says that the industry is winning on this issue. What would you do for the other side?
What would I do if I were working for the industry, or what would I do if I were working for the activists?
The activists.
I would focus on uncertainty. Because it's very hard for the activists to make a solid case, and you know it's dangerous to make a case that's not solid. It's dangerous to make claims that you know that begin to fall apart over time. So you know, I mean, activists can get away with that much more than industry can. You know, I mean, you know, when you're on the reassuring side of a controversy, you're really held to the data. When you're on the alarming side, you're not so constrained. It's people find exaggerated alarmism much more acceptable than exaggerated reassurance, which makes sense. You know, I mean, you know, if you're telling people not to worry about something, you damn well better be right. If you're telling people to worry about something, you know, you ought to have reason to think it's worth worrying about. But you know, a false positive, a false alarm, is not nearly as serious as a false reassurance. If I were on the alarmist side, I would be saying, look, this, you know, the industry claims that this is not a new technology, but that's crap. I mean, read what they're telling their shareholders. They've been telling their shareholders this is new and exciting, you know, while they're telling regulators, you know, we've been doing this for decades. Which one do you believe? When they say this is new and exciting, that's the one you got to believe. And it is new. And who knows? Maybe it can be done safely. But they don't know that for now, for sure. And this is the same industry that got this right wrong and got this wrong and got this wrong and got this wrong. As activists, here I'm trying to talk in the activist voice, as activists, we could be persuaded that this technology can be done safely. We can't be persuaded that these companies are going to do it safely. These are companies that are renowned for cutting corners. And if they were ever going to cut corners, they're going to cut corners now. It's the price of natural gas has fallen. It's a highly competitive industry. Some of these companies are losing their shirts on shale gas exploitation. And what do companies do when they're not making as much money as they promised their shareholders they were going to make? They cut corners. And they're probably not, ruining the world on purpose because, you know, they don't, you know, it's not good business to ruin the world on purpose. But if you have a lot of uncertainty and you're under a lot of economic pressure, you know, you figure, well, we don't actually know it's dangerous to cut this particular corner. It might be okay, and we really need the money, so let's cut that corner.
And if you were the industry?
Well, for one thing, if I were the industry, I wouldn't be cutting corners. If I were the industry, I would be saying, look, all energy exploitation is dangerous. Okay, this energy exploitation is a lot less dangerous than some others. Now, a lot depends. You know, part of the problem is these industries are integrated in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, the best argument on behalf of shale gas is anti-coal. You know, because shale gas replaces coal as a fuel for power plants, and you'd have to be an incredible anti-fracking activist to think that shale gas is worse than coal, because coal is horrible. But some of them, they're some of the same companies, so they don't want to trash coal. I would, if I were they and just trying to sell, you know, shale gas fracking, I would be saying, you know, well, this may be safer than wind. I'd be saying, look, this may be more dangerous than wind. This may be more environmentally harmful than wind, but nobody knows how to produce enough power with wind to power your stereo, much less your car. And that ain't gonna work. Maybe renewables are the future. Maybe they're not the future. We don't know that. What we know is they're not the present. That we haven't got. What we need to make renewables work in the here and now. So our choices in the here and now are gas, oil, coal, and nuclear. Okay, and you got to decide which one you hate the least. Okay, and you know, there's a very good case if you're an environmentalist that the one you hate the least, especially if you're an environmentalist, is worried about all the wars we've been fighting for, you know, in the Middle East and all the wars we're threatening to fight in the Middle East. You start thinking, oh, well, you know, what I really want is a source of energy that's domestic and isn't coal. That's the argument I'd be making.
I can see why you have such a nice apartment. I need 5 seconds of silence, just basically room tone for editing purposes. Peter, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
How do you want to be identified?
I'm a risk communication consultant. I'm almost a retired risk communication consultant. You probably shouldn't say that.
No, I won't.
I don't want to be completely retired. Mm-hmm. I'm a risk communication consultant based in New York. I work with clients all over the world. And I do basically three things for a living. When something is dangerous.
Say that again.
Yeah. I'm a risk communication consultant based in New York. I work with clients all over the world. And I do basically three things for a living. When something is dangerous and people are ignoring it, I get hired to alert them to the risk, to scare them, if you will, to arouse their concern, arouse their outrage, get them to pay attention. When something isn't terribly dangerous and people are freaking out, I get hired to calm them down, which is really figuring out why they're freaking out and what my client is doing wrong that's making them freak out so that my client can stop exacerbating the problem. Okay? And then the third thing I do, which we really haven't talked about, is the high hazard, high outrage paradigm. When something is upsetting, and rightly upsetting because it's genuinely dangerous. That's crisis communication, it's not what industry calls crisis communication. Industry calls crisis communication what I call outrage management. When people are upset and mad at the company, they call you up in the middle of the night and say, that's a crisis. That's a reputation crisis, but it's not a real crisis. A real crisis is a high hazard, high outrage risk. An infectious disease outbreak in your community. People are dying and they're very worried and very upset. And they're right. A tornado, a devastating natural disaster of any kind. A plant explosion, a factory explosion. Those are crises. Those are high hazard, high outrage risks. That's yet a third paradigm.
And what do you do with that?
The single most important thing to do in crisis is to avoid telling people not to be upset. Because the tendency in a crisis, if you're the official in charge, is to try to calm people down. It's to act as if you were in an outrage management job. When I intervene in crises, when I advise a client in a crisis, the most important thing I do is get the client to stop telling people that they shouldn't be upset, because that's not so. They should be upset. They're right to be upset. And the role model here is Winston Churchill during World War II, who didn't go to the people of England and say, calm down, it's just the Nazis. That's not what he did. He voiced determination rather than optimism. And the message in a crisis isn't calm down. The message in a crisis is we'll get through this together.
Blood, sweat, toil, and tears?
Blood, sweat, toil, and tears. Let's figure out what to do about this devastating situation. Of course you're afraid. I'm afraid too. This is a scary moment in our shared history. Let's figure out how to cope with it together.
You're awesome.